KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Resolution Fest, October 1st through 8th in Portland. Resolution Fest is a week-long celebration of the people and communities reimagining the landscape of the tech industry. Over 8 days, the intersections of technology, identity, culture, community service, education, social change, collaboration, and creativity will be examined. There will be documentary screenings, a Women Who Code Portland Networking Night, a Hacker Lounge, and much, much more. Again, that's Resolution Fest, October 1st through 8th, all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, houseless campers swept off the Springwater Corridor are being pushed out again from their new camping spots. We speak live with Backpacks of Hope about what's next.
Don't Shoot Portland occupies the mayor's office. Mayor Hale says he'll be sitting down to talk with them in the future.
And we'll look more closely at the new changes to Oregon's cannabis law coming up October 1st.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 26, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Six Portland area hospitals and healthcare organizations plan to donate more than $21 million to finance three new affordable housing projects in the city. The three projects feature mixed residential and medical facilities and would create more than 380 new housing units. The projects will be located at 122nd and Northeast Burnside, 126th and Southeast Stark, and North Interstate Avenue at Deakum Street. The North Interstate and Southeast Stark projects would serve both low-income residents and families who have been displaced by Portland's rapidly rising rental prices. The 122nd and Burnside project will provide both housing and medical care for medically fragile persons and people in recovery from drug addiction or mental illness. Adventist Healthcare is providing $1.5 million for the projects, while Care Oregon, Kaiser, Legacy, OHSU, and Providence are all kicking in $4 million apiece. Construction is set to begin next summer and take about 18 months. At the start of this month, the city of Portland officially swept all the campers out of the Springwater Corridor. A small community of volunteers helped hundreds of people find new camping places, including Amanda Elizabeth and the group Rose City Backpacks of Hope. But this week, all the people Amanda and her crew helped out were cited for camping again and must move. We're very privileged to have at the KBOO Studios tonight Amanda and Jason Pilcher, both of Rose City Backpacks of Hope. Amanda, Jason, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Amanda, why don't you start us off first? What happened today?
Today, we were supporting a camp that was actually named after me, Camp Amanda. This camp peacefully left the corridor 2 weeks before the actual sweep, and kind of got together and built kind of a model like Hazelnut Grove, code of conduct and everything. They were told that they had 2 months that they were safe where they were at, and then they were posted Friday due to be swept today, actually. And a lot of us advocates showed up from various organizations and with protest signs in protest. The Rangers and the East Precinct never showed up today, so we're expecting them tomorrow at 8 a.m.
How did you get word that they were going to show up today?
And they actually, on the post, they said they were showing up, and then verbally they told the campers there that they would be there this morning, and they got occupied with another cleanup down the trail, so they didn't make it to Camp Amanda today.
Is that something they communicated to you? You found that out through other means?
Actually, they did communicate it to us.
But they made it clear they're coming by tomorrow?
Yes.
And is there any kind of event planned for tomorrow? Are you guys just going to go along with the sweep? Is there any kind of protest involved?
We're protesting it. We are standing our ground. We are asking them to give us a viable place. And if they are wanting that camp to move, give us somewhere to go. We're standing our ground peacefully, asking people to come out and support. The campers they don't want to move. They don't have anywhere to go.
So. I have a lot more questions, but I wanted to let cable listeners know that there is a Facebook page where they can get information if they want to support the protest.
Yes.
And could you give us the page is, how they can find that?
Yeah, if you just go on to Rose City Backpacks of Hope, you'll find it. Or also you can put in the search engine Rose City for Hope. So.
And Jason, you were there this morning too
at
the camp. And how did you get started helping the houseless Portlanders?
I actually started with a different organization, Feeding People, and I met Amanda and knew I wanted to be a part of this organization.
Is that other organization, can you name that? Are they still involved?
Oh, yes,
too?
Free Hot Soup. We work with them.
Mm. Yeah.
So we feed people around the Portland area.
And you've both been doing this for quite a while.
Yeah.
Well, they actually named the camp after you, Amanda.
Yes.
That's quite an honor.
Yes, it is an honor.
And Amanda, how did you get started then with helping houseless Portlanders?
Well, real quick, I was homeless myself for 7 years in a city where it was illegal and I didn't have a whole lot of help. And then after being housed for 9 years, I decided that I wanted to give back to my community and help my houseless brothers and sisters. So we started providing backpacks with supplies and food, and then it grew into feeding hot meals and doing huge like clothing closets mobily. And then as soon as the sweep started happening, we became a huge part of advocating for them out there and helping them find safe places and things like that.
What was that city where you were originally homeless, a houseless?
Spokane, Washington.
And what do you find the differences, between the government regulations in Spokane versus Portland?
In Spokane, if I was caught sleeping anywhere, in any hour, I was arrested or asked to move. I didn't probably get more than 45 minutes of sleep. It didn't matter where I was laying my head. There were no communities established there at all. They had shelters. They had places where you could get a hot meal, but that was about it.
Would you say that Portland's more welcoming, but maybe headed in the direction of Spokane?
I do. Yes, I do. They are a lot more advocates out there on foot, on the ground, than there are in Spokane. There are some great groups in Spokane now, but back when I was homeless, it wasn't anything like Portland. But I do see Portland heading in a very negative direction.
Now, you actually started this, it seems small, but now it's become something
huge
as you use the term.
Huge, bigger
I hesitate
than
to use that because there's other people who use it in different ways.
It's become a lot bigger than I ever expected. We are actually really huge in the Southeast Portland area and out on the grounds every day.
And Jason, you're part of this strategy. How did you strategize moving so many people off the Springwater Trail?
We just get out there and do it. I mean, we understand that these people don't have anywhere to go and don't have the means to move all of their stuff, whatever they have, their tent, their belongings. And we just put them in, like my truck. We just put everybody in my truck, put their stuff in the truck, move to a new spot. If we don't have a spot, we'll go actively look for a spot.
How did you find the spot where I guess the big sweep's going to take place tomorrow? So this is Southeast 114th and Foster.
Amanda had a great big part in that, so I'll let her answer.
Oh, sure.
I actually took three of the residents from the from Lambert Field, and we went on a 2-day field trip. We got in a van and we just went. It was like apartment hunting, but outside. And
what do you look for? I'm just curious.
Whether it's city or parks property, private or privately owned. If it's city, we check it out and see how many people it will hold. If it's safe, if it's away from everyone's view, that's what we look for. Sadly, I mean, I'm helping my friends look for a new place to live, but it's outside, behind bushes, trees. Yeah, you know, it's actually really heart-wrenching.
Oh, certainly. What about tomorrow then? We're expecting the police to come up, I hope, with an alternative location.
Rather
than just sweep everybody away. Yeah. Do you think that's going to happen, or are they just going to get lost kind of thing?
I think they're going to come in and do what they're asked to do. Tonight I'm going to put a call out for people to call into the commissioners, Amanda Fritz and Nick Fish. They're the ones that actually, because of the area they have the power to put a stop to tomorrow's sweep. I do not have high hopes, honestly. Basically, I'm trying to take a camp that's turned their lives around and turned themselves around and use this as a way to call out to the city and say, no more sweeps. This is killing them. It's killing us. So.
And we're talking about people who might have been on their second, third, or even fourth location at this point.
Oh, yes.
We could imagine, just somebody moving from one apartment to another is quite a life-changing experience.
Wouldn't that be tiring to you to pack up all your house, every other week?
And that's voluntary, too. I'm just talking about a regular move, obstructive it can be,
Here
people who have no choice and they don't know when the police are going to arrive and move them to another location or even recommend another one. I'd like to ask a few questions about the conditions that people are living under. Jason, you could take these if you'd like,
sure.
Or Amanda. First of all, what's the conditions like currently, say at 114th and Foster, and what were they like along the Springwater Corridor?
Well, it's a night and day difference between the Springwater Corridor and where they're at right now. Right now, they are a active, clean, beautiful camp. We've had a lot of people come in today. We pretty much did an open house with anybody that came up and asked us what was going on over there. People walked through. They said, this is not what I expected it was going to be. It's tidy, straightened up. They have little guardrails next to the trail that the houseless people put there. And I don't like to use the word homeless because these people do have homes. Their homes are mobile, and we're trying to stop them from being mobile. We'd like to have them in a permanent place. And a lot of people voiced that to me today, that they are not homeless. They are houseless.
And are there families there, or like children at the camps, the houseless camps?
Well, there are at camps, not this camp. Camp Amanda is actually a lot of older people. There are people with disabilities, there are animals, real friendly people.
Yeah, it's a camp with a few of our vulnerable, just a small community. And this isn't, I just want to touch on this, this isn't the only community that has been posted. We have many that we're fighting for right now, currently, so.
And Jason, you mentioned how well organized this is. Amanda, earlier you had said that you're modeling this after the Hazelnut Grove community, which was fairly successful.
Right.
Is that how this became so organized? Were you guys very much involved in getting the houseless together and getting those guardrails up and putting regulations and guidelines in place?
As far as the aesthetics and putting the camp together, they did it. It was all them. We, as advocates, explain to them how other camps are, like the code of conduct. This camp has a code of conduct. They're not
some sanctioned kind of anarchic.
Camp. They're not a sanctioned camp.
But
they are acting like a sanctioned camp. And I think the city should look at this and use this as a model for other camps.
And how did that code of conduct come about? Was that adapted from the Hazelnut Grove camp?
I actually held meetings with Camp Amanda before it became Camp Amanda and suggested that there be rules set and a code of conduct. And so I did contact a couple members of Hazelnut Grove and kind of got a good idea of what should be on a code of conduct. And I went to them with that. And then they created their own. They adapted their own and did an amazing job. So I have been going back and forth with members of Hazelnut Grove on how to do this.
What are the, are you communicating with some of the neighbors in the area too? Or are they very much against the houseless camp there as they were in the Springwater Corridor, but not so much in Hazelnut Grove?
As of right now, the neighbors were very much hesitant and against it until today when they came through and met the people there and walked through and explained how incredibly beautiful the camp was and how impressed they were and how safe they felt.
Oh, so that's something they had no impression of before today.
No, before today.
No, absolutely not.
Did you guys both arrange that and your organization, Backpack
yes,
of Hope?
Yes.
Oh, how'd you go about doing that? Was there like a neighborhood group, some kind of community organization?
As outreach workers, we reach out to the neighbors when we can and let them know if a camp's coming up. Unfortunately, because of the sweep, we weren't able to do that with a lot of the camps. So.
And you had mentioned, again, as outreach, is that something that you do, you go door-to-door in the neighborhood and talk to the neighbors and invite them to a community event and to see the houseless camp?
Not typically, but that is something we want to do. We don't want to have to hide these people from their neighbors. I mean, you don't want to be hidden from your neighbor. I mean, I don't know. You might have a bad neighbor, but
I think that's the rare case.
But yes.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. You want a sense of community.
Yes.
You want people to know each other where you're not fearful of your neighbors and you're coming together to help each other when you need the help.
And there's absolutely no reason to fear anybody in Camp Amanda. It is a great camp. They're good people. They just want to survive just like the rest of us.
Now, that's something that becomes clear to the neighbors when they meet the people in the houseless camps.
Yeah.
Yes.
You could easily see that because, I mean, you have that kind of fear of the other when you don't know who's in there. And I guess the stereotype is drug addicts and criminals and all that. But obviously, that's not the case.
It's not.
It's not.
And it's a lot. I mean, there are a lot of, like the city. Hey, there's a lot of crime going on in this camp. Well, you have that in the housed community as well. It's not just, it's isolated people. It's not everybody. The stereotype is, it's ridiculous. I mean, they have really good people out here.
So why are the police conducting the sweep then? What was the pressures? If the neighbors are kind of okay with it as of today's visit, is there a reason why they want everybody out at this location?
There's a along Foster Road. There are about four or five RVs out there that have nothing to do with the camp that had a lot of drug activity. And I actually just found this out today that was the true reason behind conducting the sweep of Camp Amanda.
Oh.
So pretty frustrating.
So just a few kind of ruined for everybody else.
Yeah.
But there's no way to kind of discriminate there and deal directly with the problems. I mean, it's kind of like taking a community where two people commit a crime and then you have everybody move from their houses, their apartments to get them all out there.
Well, just imagine an RV parking in front of your house and start dealing drugs out of it and people start associating you with that.
Exactly.
That's not fair.
It's exactly what happened. So.
Is there any recourse to stop the sweep then beyond a peaceful protest to civil disobedience?
Like I said, phone calls. I'm going to reach out the best that I can. But 8 a.m. comes early, comes soon and early. And hopefully maybe the message that we got across today will be helpful. We did a very, very, very peaceful protest today. Got lots of attention, both media and within the neighborhood.
And Amanda, who else is helping Backpacks of Hope in this effort?
Portland Tenants United, Ad5, Steve Kynes from the Red Barn, and then just volunteers from the community.
All over.
Yeah.
Oh, and just again for cable listeners who want to come out and support the houseless camp and try to prevent the relocation, where can they go for more information?
Like I said, go to Rose City Backpacks of Hope. If you will have a new event up tonight, you can message us. We get back to you really quickly, within minutes. So.
Oh, well, thanks very much, Amanda.
Thanks,
Justin. That was Amanda Elizabeth and Justin Pilcher of Backpack of Hope. You can support them at Rose City Backpacks of Hope on Facebook.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has invited Don't Shoot Portland to meet with him and the Portland Police Chief after the group marched on Friday from the Lloyd Center area across the Burnside Bridge and into the mayor's office. Hundreds of protesters with the No More Sidelines, This Stops Now protest disrupted traffic for several hours as they marched through town toward the mayor's office. The protesters entered City Hall and began chanting for the mayor. After about an hour, the mayor finally appeared and talked to the protesters, agreeing to officially meet with the group on Tuesday. Mayor Hales also announced that the current police chief would also attend the meeting. Organizers with Black Lives Matter said the march and protest was in response to the recent police killings of unarmed black men in both Tulsa and Charlotte. The group also cited the August 10th murder of 19-year-old Larnell Bruce Jr. in Gresham by a longtime convict and self-admitted white supremacist. Organizers are calling that murder a hate crime, but Gresham police say they cannot yet prove the murder was motivated by the victim's race.
As all eyes turn to New York City and the first presidential debate tonight, Saturday's Oregon governor debate seems to have passed very quietly. Governor Kate Brown and Republican challenger Bud Pierce are facing off on the November ballot for the right to fill the rest of former Governor John Kitzhaber's term. The debate held in Bend last night shed no new light on the two candidates, who essentially held down party-line opinions on social issues, including a new corporate tax. Brown favors the tax, but Pierce argued it would, quote, drive up the cost of living. While Pierce did not say outright that he would cut social programs, Brown accused him of planning to. Pierce instead said Oregon should, quote, redirect funds away from state bureaucracies. Speaking about a proposed federal monument on Southeast Oregon, Pierce said locals opposed the move. He proposed a plan where the federal government would transfer ownership of land to the state and county government.
Today, hundreds of Reed College students, faculty, and staff are boycotting work and class. Organized by a dozen black students and non-black student allies, the boycott is a response to Isaiah Washington's call for a national day of boycott. Washington urged the public to stay home from work and school and to avoid spending money at stores across the U.S. for all of today. On Reed's campus, students planned 12 hours of events to focus on systemic racism and the experiences of black bodies. As of this afternoon, just short of 100 faculty members voiced their support of the protest, as well as nearly 500 students. Midway through the events, black students will announce a list of demands with hopes to encourage institutional change. Only 6 out of 156 Reed faculty members are black, and black students have a retention rate of only 50%. Student organizers at Reed College say they stand with the Black Lives Matter movement and National Day of Boycott movement and welcome the greater Portland community to come to campus and participate.
A 20-year-old shooter killed 5 people with a rifle at the Cascade Mall in Burlington Saturday. Arjan Cheetan of Oak Harbor, Washington, had previously been arrested for beating his stepfather. Cheetan opened fire at the makeup counter in Macy's. The 5 victims included 4 women, ranging in age from 16 to 95 years old, and one man who died later. The teenage victim, Sarai Lara, was a cancer survivor whose family was originally from Mexico.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with clouds and a high near 74 degrees. Today in history, in 2011, Wangari Maathai, the first African-American woman recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, died in Nairobi. The quote of the day is from Wangari Maathai, who said, "In a few decades, the relationship between the environment, resources, and conflict may seem almost as obvious as the connection we see today between the human rights, democracy, and peace."
An African-American gunman opened fire at a Houston mall today, leaving at least 9 people injured. The suspect was shot down by police, said Houston Police Chief Martha Montalvo. 3 victims were treated at the scene, while the 6 others were sent to area hospitals. Multiple weapons were found in the suspect's car, and a bomb squad was sent to search the vehicle. The suspect was a neighborhood lawyer who was having troubles with his law firm. The FBI is assisting the Houston police as the investigation continues.
A military prison disciplinary board has ruled that Chelsea Manning will face up to 14 days in solitary confinement for her July suicide attempt. Manning is serving a 35-year military prison sentence for giving classified documents to the WikiLeaks whistleblower organization. The United Nations has ruled that the use of solitary confinement in prisons constituted a form of torture.
The severe flooding that hit Baton Rouge and neighboring towns in Louisiana last month has caused lingering problems for hundreds of thousands of residents. The flood killed 13 people, displaced tens of thousands, destroyed some 60,000 houses, and caused an estimated $8.7 billion in damage. The disaster was the worst in the state since Hurricane Katrina submerged much of New Orleans and the surrounding area in 2005. To find out more about the aftermath of the Louisiana flood of 2016 and the current state of relief efforts, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Kobe, who's on the ground working with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief.
We are joined on the line now by Kobe, who is from Baton Rouge and can tell us a little bit about what's been going on there. Now, Kobe, it's been nearly a month since some massive flooding hit Baton Rouge. What is the situation on the ground? Are people getting the help that they need?
Well, it's a really tricky situation because right now most of the help is coming from local grassroots organizations. The Red Cross, their help has been lacking, to say the least. And so even since the flood recovery started, a lot of people are saved by just average citizens going out in their boats and helping to rescue other people. And since then, the people who have been really gutting houses and making sure that people have a safe place to live have been just like other local people forming groups and communities. So right now it's really hard because there's still a lot of people who are not at home and they're living with families, they're living in hotels, and they're still living in shelters.
What are some of the organizations that are actually on the ground helping people, and how are they doing that?
There are a few really good ones. One of them is Mutual Aid, and they're comprised of people from all over the country. If anyone out there who wants to volunteer, we can set you up, just get you out here working. It's really easy just to learn how to tear down some drywall and just to kind of come and lend like manual labor, because we really, really need that. Other great organizations in Baton Rouge have been Together Baton Rouge, and they've even put people to work at a $15 minimum wage who were displaced from their jobs, and now they're working full-time gutting houses.
In Baton Rouge, people experienced this flooding. Now, Baton Rouge itself isn't necessarily a coastal city. How did this flooding come about that was so severe, and what led to it that people ended up in this situation?
You're right. Baton Rouge isn't a coastal city, and we had no warning that this flood was coming. With a hurricane, you have time to prepare. You can make sure you have enough food and groceries and some sandbags. But with this, it was, I think, October 12th, and it started raining, and it just never stopped. And we are inland, and a lot of these areas are not in flood zones. They are not in places where people need to have flood insurance. And it just kept coming until the waters kept rising, and then pretty soon your whole neighborhoods were underwater in a lot of places, up to the houses, past the roofs. In my neighborhood, it was up past the windows in a lot of areas. And there was really just no time to prepare because we had no idea that this was going to happen. No warning, no like advanced systems, anything. It took us all by surprise. And it was really hard to kind of adjust after that.
Has the Federal Emergency Management Agency been on the ground, and have they shown that they have learned the lessons of Hurricane Katrina, now 11 years later, facing a similar situation also in Louisiana?
So personally, I have not seen them on the ground. Like I said, the people that we've been seeing have been grassroots organizations. We haven't seen a lot of federal response. And that's not to say that a lot of it's there, but it might not be as prominent, and it's not to the where people are really feeling like the help is coming. Even I know that FEMA, they give homeowners some money if their houses have been destroyed. Some people are getting $2,000 and their next door neighbor is getting nothing. The people of Baton Rouge don't feel like the federal government has necessarily stepped up.
Your group, Mutual Aid, is that an organization that people could get involved with or support in some way?
Yes, we would love any kind of support. And the two biggest ways are volunteering, whether that's like manual labor. We can, if you come down to Baton Rouge, we can put you to work helping out. And then also just donations. We have Amazon wish lists, and you can send masks so people aren't breathing in mold, and wheelbarrows and sledgehammers and things to really help the people just get this taken care of.
How can people connect with your group, Mutual Aid?
So I know they have a Facebook page, and if you just Google on Facebook right now, and in the next few days there's actually going to be a website, which is going to be mutualaiddisasterrelief.org, which should be launching in the next few days.
Well, again, I want to thank you for joining us today on KBOO. I've been speaking with Kobe in Baton Rouge with Mutual Aid, that's organizing on the ground to assist many of the people who have been displaced and have had their homes destroyed by the flood there last month. And their Facebook can be found at Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The first televised presidential debate between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump will air tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. Hofstra University will host the debate, and NBC News anchor Lester Holt will moderate. The event will be aired and streamed on over a dozen television stations and websites. News organizations such as Wired and Bloomberg will provide live-streamed fact checks during the debate. Green Party nominee Jill Stein was escorted off Hofstra campus in an attempt to attend the event.
NASA has discovered evidence of Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, erupting water plumes and jets from its surface. The plumes were detected by the Hubble telescope and are presumed to come from oceans beneath icy sheets that cover the moon. Europa receives much attention from NASA and astronomers for being a candidate to support life. NASA's working to uncover more evidence and details of the water bursts.
A new study by researchers at the University of Washington has revealed that polar bears throughout the Arctic region are increasingly at risk due to declining sea ice. The researchers found that over the last 35 years, the total number of days the sea was frozen has declined by an average of 7 weeks. The report found that sea ice declined for all of the 19 distinct subpopulations of the polar bears that exist in the Arctic. Polar bears use ice floes and sea ice as their main platform for hunting. When the ice melts, they are largely landbound, where they eat a plant-based diet which does not provide enough nutrients for the bears to maintain a healthy weight and survive long term. Unlike grizzly and black bears, polar bears do not hibernate in the winter, but hunt their main source of nutrients, seals, on sea ice floes, fattening up the bears so they can survive the summer months when they eat very little. Female polar bears do den up when pregnant, emerging with their cubs usually in late winter to early spring. As the ice melts sooner in the spring, it shortens the time when female bears and their cubs can hunt and eat seals in order to gain weight to survive the lean summer months.
A prominent human rights advocate in Indian-administered Kashmir remains in jail for a second week, detained under the Jammu and Kashmir Public Safety Act. His arrest comes amid a public uprising in which government forces have killed more than 85 people since early July and blinded hundreds of others with pellet shotguns. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
Khurram Parvez is jailed under the infamous Jammu and Kashmir Public Safety Act. which allows the government to hold him without charge for as long as 6 months. Police arrested the noted human rights campaigner at his home and charged him with inciting protesters. His detention came one day after officials blocked him from traveling to Geneva to attend the UN Human Rights Council session on September 15. 5 days later, a court ordered his release, citing violations of procedure in his arrest and detention. But despite the court orders and an international outcry from human rights organizations and activists, authorities booked him under the updated Public Safety Act. The controversial law used to allow detention without trial for as long as 2 years. Now that's limited to 6 months, but is often extended. Parvez Imroz, a colleague at the Jammu Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society, or JKCCS, says the arrest was meant to silence civil society activists in Kashmir.
It is because of his work. You know, Khurrams have been working on disappearances, on mass graves, on identifying the perpetrators who have committed crimes against humanity here, and organizing the human rights work in Kashmir.
Khurram is program coordinator for the Srinagar-based JKCCS and also the chairperson of the Asian Federation Against Involuntary Disappearances, a collective of 13 non-governmental organizations from 10 Asian countries. As a rights activist, Khurram has devoted considerable time to fighting the very law under which he is now held, the Public Safety Act, which Amnesty International calls a lawless law. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
More than 14,000 Saudi women have signed a petition asking the government to abolish the tradition of male supervision. Currently, Saudi women are not allowed to drive and must have a male make their travel arrangements, among other prohibitions. A man must apply for the woman's passport and also be a guardian when the woman's traveling. A man's supervision is also required should the woman want to rent a flat, have any medical procedures performed, or when filing a legal claim. Women are also not allowed to drive vehicles. Activist Aziza Al-Youssef is the originator of the petition. She was stopped while driving in a protest in 2013. In their protest, they're demanding an answer to the question of when does a woman become an adult? As many as 2,500 women sent protests to the Saudi king over the weekend. Some Saudi women oppose having these freedoms, saying they want the system reformed. There has been no official response to their petition yet.
Indigenous leaders in Canada have snubbed the British royal family's attempt at reconciliation over past atrocities, calling it a, quote, public charade. Grand Chief Philip Stewart will not attend the Black Rock ceremony with Prince William and Princess Kate. The event, which is tonight, revolves around a ceremonial stick that commemorates Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee. A new silver band will be added to the stick to represent Indigenous people in Canada. None will be on hand to participate in the gesture. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was elected to office last year with promises he would fund programs for Indigenous youth, among other things. Court had previously ruled that the government racially discriminates against Indigenous people, but funding for the programs to address poverty and improved education do not start until after 2019. None of Trudeau's promises to the Indigenous communities have yet been honored, nor is there any real movement to do so.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Auto Workers President Dennis Williams says the UAW is focused on the election, and rank-and-file members overwhelmingly back Hillary Clinton. Williams says 75% of UAW members are voting for Hillary.
Hillary Clinton is way ahead in our membership, I tell you right now. And, you know, when we started off and we initially did our primary survey, there was about 28% of our membership that indicated through that survey that they were supporting Donald Trump. Since then we've been educating the membership on either things they have said or their track records. Hillary's numbers have went up. Donald Trump's numbers have continued to go down.
In 2012, Mitt Romney got 28% of UAW members' votes.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. There's been rioting and a person shot dead during a demonstration in the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, but let's not think that the National Football League was going to cancel any games down in that troubled city. The NFL owns one day of the week, Sunday, as the old expression goes, and it was never going to give up that day just because there was some civil unrest stemming from yet another shooting of a black man. So you had the Carolina Panthers hosting the Minnesota Vikings, a game that went off as planned and was not going to be canceled by the NFL. You know when the NFL cancels games? Hardly ever. When John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963 in Dallas, the league went ahead with its games for that Sunday because the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, took the advice of a close Kennedy advisor, Pierre Salinger, who said that Kennedy would have wanted it that way. That particular decision haunted Rozelle for the rest of his life because it was obviously the wrong thing to do. The NFL did take the highly unusual move of canceling its full slate of games on September 16, 2001, but only because it had learned its lesson from the JFK assassination and was responding to the September 11th attacks that came 5 days earlier in New York and Washington. But that's it. The NFL does not recognize demonstrators or civil unrest or police brutality or any of the other things that have now taken over the national discussion. Remember, this is the mighty NFL, and the NFL owns Sunday, even in a troubled city like Charlotte, North Carolina.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at IBEW.org. Brought to you by Union Active, affordable, state-of-the-art web design using responsive web technology with easy-to-use content tools, member management features, and a host of other tools that make Union Active your perfect web solution. Designs, prices, and features are online at unionactive.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Natasha Delapine, Kyle Koreshki, Rosalind Scott, and Ken Jones. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Kittens Everywhere. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show. At 9, we'll hear a special second hour of Democracy Now! Focused on the presidential debate and featuring some of those excluded from tonight's debate. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints. At 11, Stage and Studio presents an adaptation of the Breast Cancer Monologues. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan speaks with Molly Alloy about her shows Embody at the Ready Cafe and Ferguson Water at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our fall membership drive. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
All medicinal and or recreational cannabis products must have their labeling officially approved by October 1st. There are new packaging regulations coming into effect as well. KBOO's Natasha Delapine spoke with Jamie Dickinson of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
I am the packaging and labeling specialist for the recreational marijuana program for the OLCC. In this position, I review, evaluate, and approve the packages and labels for both the recreational as well as the medical marijuana program. The labeling before, it just had different requirements. Part of these requirements came from the legislature, so there are some things that are now required by statute that weren't before, for example, the activation time. So some of these changes came about with the legalization of recreational marijuana. The labeling before, the labeling now, I should say, has been influenced with the new recreational program. Prior to October 1st, the medical program that is regulated by the Oregon Health Authority has had regulations put in place for a long time. And in 2015, the Oregon Health Authority created new labeling standards for both recreational and medical. These rules were updated and they were made permanent in June of 2016, and those are the rules that are going into place on October 1st. I should say that the October 1st date is kind of a deadline for the medical program, so all medical products have to be compliant with these labeling rules starting on October 1st. The recreational, so anybody that has an OLCC license, they have to be compliant with the rules before they sell a product. So the differences between these labeling rules is that the current rules require a lot more information. There's a lot more tracking information. There's different warnings that are required to be on the label, including a new universal symbol that must go on every label. And the universal symbol was created by the Oregon Health Authority. I'm sure everybody's going to see it at some point. It is a marijuana leaf with an exclamation point.
Beyond the symbol, there's more data on the packaging itself. Could you describe an example or a few examples of the new information that you would find on packaging?
Sure. So one thing is an activation time. So all products except for seeds and plants have to have an activation time listed on them. And this is the time in which a consumer is likely to feel the effects of the product. That's one example. Edibles have quite a few new requirements that have to go on them. One of the warnings